Our next speaker is Rabbi Dr. Reddy Reichman. To many of us again, Dr. Reichman has been here in our conference and has been a regular participant, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. Rabbi Reichman is a professor of medicine at Yeshiva University. I don't say that anymore. Sorry. Albert Einstein, right? At the Albert Einstein ACOM of Yeshiva University in White. He's also an ordained rabbi from Reitz, but many of us know him as really a wonderful speaker in terms of his knowledge and his erudite presentations. There's always a new presentation. We always look forward to the year in review in which we fast forward time, and I don't know where he finds the time to find these articles, newspaper articles, Yahoo, wherever they come from, but it's always an entertaining session. And all of the sessions are always very, very special. So without further ado, this session will be followed, if by the way, in your handout. So I will leave this now Spain up for you to gaze when you are not looking at your handout. Rabbi Reichman.
Shkayach, great to see so many of you, so many old faces, so many new faces, some people getting older faces. It is such a pleasure and delight to be here. Very excited to share this weekend with you. Just Laser commented on the relationship between Montefiore and Einstein. Just an interesting observation. Take it for what it's worth. Montefiore was actually a very frum person. Einstein, as you know, is an atheist. So I find it quite ironic that Montefiore is making Einstein not frum. Just an interesting observation. In any case, I'm not using a PowerPoint tonight, so I guess you could say in a certain sense my presentation is pointless. And also, just another brief comment, many of us took haircuts before the 3 weeks. It reminds me of a story of a rabbi who was giving a talk. And in the middle of a talk, one of his prominent congregants stood up and left the shul. And the rabbi didn't say anything at the time. He was a little offended. And a little time later, a few days later, he happened upon this gentleman on the street. And he said, sir, you know, why did you leave my shear in the middle? So he said, Rabbi, I needed to take a haircut. So he said, why didn't you take a haircut before the lecture? Said, Rabbi, I didn't need to take a haircut before the lecture. Now, we are going to be spending a lot of time together. We're going to probably need a haircut by the time we finish all these sessions together, but we have the luxury of uniting together for a lot of extremely qualitative sessions. And I come here not only as a speaker, I stand in awe of the others who share this podium. I come really to learn, just like all of you here, from the other extraordinary speakers, from which we can learn so much. If you turn to page 4 of your handouts, you will see an illustration that I came across this year. It's a magnificent illustration of a Torah which is comprised of DNA. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words. In this sense, I guess you could say a picture is worth 80,000 words, which is roughly the number of words in the Sefer Torah. Or in this sense, a picture is worth 3 billion base pairs, which is the number of base pairs in the human DNA. Just a challenge for you, for those of you who are interested in taking it, a creative writing challenge. I'm sure you'll have plenty of time over the course of the next few days. If you were to write a little paragraph describing what this illustration means to you, what would you write? I was very captivated by this illustration, and I came up with a couple interesting ideas, which I will share with you, Mirtz Hashem, in our last session together on Sunday. But I'm curious what you will think of. I welcome you to this year's annual Medical Halacha Update. As in every year, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has allowed us to make some really extraordinary discoveries, and in a sense, well, this session is a medical halacha update. This entire conference really is a medical halacha update, as you will see. Many of the things that we'll be briefly referencing will be fleshed out in sessions by either myself or some of the other speakers here. And what we will do briefly for the next few minutes is literally cover from the beginning of life to the end of life some of the fascinating highlights over the course of the year and just mention some of their potential halachic ramifications. We begin with the world of genetics, the beginning of life, and we'll move our way through the course of the end of life. We see here on this page some interesting developments in the world of genetics and genetic therapy. And don't be offended that I'm turning to my phone. There is a reason I'm using my phone, as you'll see in just a moment. So genetics, there's been extraordinary advances, which we're going to hear about here at our conference. One of the areas where there's been tremendous development is the world of genetic therapy. So over the last couple years, you're all familiar with the development of the Human Genome Project, identifying all these different genes which are related to diseases. The next step and the objective of the identification of these diseases is the curing of these diseases. Genetic therapy or genetic manipulation. So the standard or conventional genetic therapy, which we have been exposed to over the last couple years in its experimental phases, not yet reached the clinical phase in any of these experiments, is to correct the missing gene or the missing enzyme. And you have some of these therapies listed for you on this handout. For example, on the top of page 4, there is a study showing, proving dramatically effective in stopping MLD, an inherited disorder that strikes in childhood and destroys the brain's white matter. The therapy involves adding a correct copy of a gene to a child's bone marrow. And that's the concrete thinking. If you're missing the gene, replace the gene. And in fact, the reason I'm holding my phone, to make sure that this is a genuine medical halacha update to give you as current as possible, this is from the New York Times from today. FDA panel recommends approval for gene-altering leukemia therapy. Food and Drug Administration panel opened a new era in medicine Wednesday, unanimously recommending that the agency approve the first ever treatment that genetically alters a patient's own cells to fight cancer. And if you read this article, it's really quite extraordinary. They, in essence, extract T cells from the human body, genetically modify those T cells, and train them to be soldiers, if you will, or arm them or weaponize them to attack the B cells in the body, and they reinsert them into that patient's own body, and they attack that patient's own B cells. It's really a phenomenal concept, and it apparently, based on these studies, has been quite successful. But as all of us in the healthcare profession need to know, is that we need to have a little humility, and that's reflected here in this handout as well. On the middle of the page, Juno halts cancer trial using gene-altered cells after 3 deaths. And not only in genetic therapy do we have deaths in trials, but even more humbling, on the very bottom of this page, first in human clinical trials, what we can learn from tragic failures. On January, a healthy volunteer who received 50 milligrams of a fatty acid inhibitor for 5 days as part of a phase 1 trial, sustained neurological disturbances and ultimately died as a result. Literally taking a fatty acid pill, was not sick at all. So halacha clearly governs these things. Jews, by the way, are always the first to line up for experimental therapies. Many of the medical centers advertise in the Jewish newspapers for those interested in becoming subjects, because they know that the Jews are very much interested in facilitating the advance in medicine and science. But there are guidelines, and there's much to discuss about this, but in brief, on the bottom of this handout, you have just one small excerpt from the former chief rabbi, Rabbi Lau, delineating what the parameters are in terms of engaging in these kinds of experiments. And there's clearly a fundamental difference whether you are an ill patient who can benefit from this therapy or whether you are simply a healthy volunteer who's applying to perform some research. In the latter, of course, you need to be extremely cautious that the risks are exceedingly small. But let us turn the page as we move forward. That was the forms of gene therapy we talked about really in the late 19th, early 20th century, which were concrete gene therapy, replacing the missing enzymes, replacing the missing genes. But what you will hear about tomorrow is the latest frontier of genetic technology, and that's the field of CRISPR. How many people here before this conference are familiar with the CRISPR by show of hands? So many people are, so here that's a pretty literate audience. A relatively high percentage of you are familiar with the CRISPR technology. You'll be treated to a wonderful presentation by Rabbi Dr. Steinberg on this topic tomorrow. I was introduced to CRISPR when I opened the refrigerator and saw the drawer on the bottom right-hand side. But one thing which you may not have realized is that, well, tomorrow you'll be treated to a discussion about CRISPR in the human being, or ultimately to be advanced to application to the human being. CRISPR technology, which is gene modification, is also being used for foods. And it's very fascinating. On the bottom here, these foods aren't genetically modified, but they are edited. As you will hear about the exact understanding of how CRISPR works, CRISPR does not work by introducing new genes into the food. It actually alters the existing genes. And what's fascinating is that the FDA will modify genetically modified foods only if there is an external gene from another creature which is introduced into the genome. If you are simply editing an existing genome, the FDA has no regulation whatsoever. So it's quite possible that you are going to see foods on your shelf that are modified through this CRISPR genetically modified process, which you have no idea that they're actually being genetically modified. You may be familiar that there is a salmon which is enhanced genetically by the introduction of a gene from an eel, which is a non-kosher creature. And there are fascinating halachic discussions about whether the introduction of that small gene fragment from an eel renders this otherwise kosher salmon to be non-kosher. But let us turn to the next page, page 6. And don't worry, we're not going to go through all of the entries here. These are for you to read and discuss. Many of these are fascinating and thought-provoking. Let us skip to the middle one on this page, page 6. While we're in the aspect of beginning of life, even though this relates to transplantation, which is more end of life, you'll see why this is more at the beginning of life in this presentation. There are hundreds, more than 100,000, between 100,000 and 200,000 people in the United States that are waiting for organs. And there are many areas of advancement in the field of organ transplantation trying to minimize that number. Thousands of people every year die awaiting organ transplants that are unable to receive them. One of the ways that is being experimented with is this really fascinating way. The NIH may fund human-animal stem cell research. And let me explain what the technology is here. The technology is as follows. You can take a sheep, for example, in its early embryological phase, remove the cells of that sheep that would normally produce a sheep liver, replace those cells with human stem cells that will produce a liver. So in essence, what you will have is a sheep that grows like a normal sheep, but will have a human liver in its body. So instead of having to wait for, God forbid, somebody to die or somebody to donate a liver as a living donor, you can actually call up the farm and say, you know, I need a liver in the OR tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they will slaughter the sheep and give the liver for the operating room. So the question from a halachic perspective is, if you shechted that sheep, are you allowed to eat the liver? Is the liver a human liver, or is the liver a sheep liver? Now, this liver is, say, 5% of the human body. Let's say it had human liver cells, human kidney cells, human lung cells, human heart cells. And 51% of the sheep was now comprised of human cells, and it was grazing in the fields. Is it a sheep, or is it a human being? So this is a very important fundamental question. This is not science fiction. Nothing we are talking about here is science fiction. It's all based on sound clinical evidence. So this very interesting Yerushalmi, which bears on this question. On the left-hand side, you'll see it's in line 2 of the Hebrew source. Behevias divrei ha-Yerushalmi, shehakol toli butzura sapanim. How do you differentiate when you have a creature which is comprised of two different species, animal species and human species? So the Rishalmi says you differentiate by its facial features, the morphology of the face. She'im kulo adam upanav kebehema, that if its torso is entirely man, or humanoid, but its face is the face of an animal. Afilu kore batora, even if that creature is reading the Torah, omrim lo bovanishchotoscha. Say, come and we will shecht you. Is there any Bali Kriya in here in the audience? Vim hayupanav ka'adam, and the opposite's also true. If its facial features were like a human being, v'kulo ka'behema, but its torso was an animal, v'choresh basod, is literally plowing the fields, omrim lo bovachalotz leishas achicha. Come and perform the Levirate ceremony, i.e., you have the full status of a human being. I'm not saying that this is the definitive answer in these human-animal mixtures, but it's just fascinating that the Yerushalmi thousands of years ago was already thinking about interspecies mixtures. As we move on to the world of infertility and reproduction, we've discussed this at this conference over the years. There are extraordinary advances, and tomorrow, actually, we're going to talk about some of those in our presentation on cryopreservation in the morning. But just to share with you some of the highlights of over the last year, tomorrow we're going to talk about freezing of human reproductive tissue and how freezing or cryopreservation is now very popular in many fascinating areas of medicine with many halachic ramifications. But this year we've seen, for example, on the bottom of this handout, the first case of a child born from eggs frozen before puberty. So eggs have been frozen after puberty, but never before have eggs been frozen before puberty have been able to be used. This reminds me, this picture on the bottom left is a picture of Angelina Jolie. This is the frumest picture that I could find of her. She looks like a Chabad shlucha. But she this past year, or 2 years ago roughly, about 4 or 5 years ago, she was famous for writing an article in the New York Times that she has had the BRCA gene and she performed a bilateral mastectomy, had the breast tissue removed. Then 2 years later, she actually had her ovarian tissue removed because of the concern for ovarian cancer. One of the things we'll talk about tomorrow is the freezing of the human egg and the indications of the freezing of the human egg, and this is actually one of those scenarios. And by the way, in the Jewish community, which I don't think we're going to discuss in any of the other sessions at the conference, freezing human eggs could become a very popular and very important part of the of our community as it interfaces with the so-called shidduch crisis. So there are many women in particular who may not as yet have found their shidduch. And sometimes these women may be reaching age where fertility or preserving a fertility might be an issue. So it is possible now to preserve the human egg at an earlier stage of life. And if the woman, Mirtz Hashem, finds her shidduch, gets married after the age of fertility, even in theory after the age of menopause, it is possible to take that frozen egg, fertilize that egg with male reproductive seed, and for her to carry that child. So the question is that something which should be recommended for Jewish women who are advancing in years as an insurance policy? And that's a very important part of our community and something which many Rabbanim are beginning to welcome. It is not unreasonable, and I say this half jokingly, that on your shidduch resume, you might actually see, you know, little column, you know, whether frozen eggs or not frozen eggs. Sounds a little in jest, but it's actually not. Speaking of technology with human reproduction, in the middle of this page 7, and you're reading this correctly, by the way, 3D printed ovaries help mice get pregnant, show promise for fertility treatments. How many people in this room own a 3D printer? Anybody? I'm surprised nobody in this room owns it. Torah in Motion doesn't have a 3D printer? So 3D printing is becoming wildly popular. 3D printing has tremendous use in the world of medicine today. Not only is it used, for example, there was a, you know, I work at Montefiore. Montefiore just separated a conjoined twins. And what they did is they took imaging of the conjoined twins, an MRI of the conjoined twins, and created a 3D sophisticated image so the surgeons could actually practice the operation before the surgery itself, so they'd be tremendously equipped to perform it. They are contemplating using 3D imaging of all soldiers before they go to the battlefield So if they have any injuries, for example, they lose a bone, they can just reprint that bone with artificial material and implant whatever's missing. And so here you have the 3D organs, the concept of printing a 3D organ. Obviously, it's more complicated depending on the organ, but is fascinating and has halachic ramifications. Are these 3D printed organs considered an aver? Is that considered a flesh? Is there a chiyuv kvura, for example, if someone passes away and has a 3D printed organ? Is there a specific requirement to bury that organ? If a Kohen has a 3D printed organ, is he considered to be missing an aver? Because even though a family member can become tameh for another family member who's a Kohen, if that family member is missing an organ, then there's no permission to violate the Isser of Tumah. So these are all fascinating questions. Uterus transplants is another topic. And the bottom of page 7 is one that Rabbi Dr. Glatt will be talking about tomorrow, which is another fascinating frontier, and that's the artificial womb. As we turn to page 8, there's much to talk about with the artificial womb, and also he'll be talking about three parents in a plastic bag. So the plastic bag is the artificial womb. The three parents I will leave for Dr. Glatt also on the top of page 8. But here in the middle of page 8, there's a really fascinating development, and I had this schus of sitting next to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg over dinner to discuss this, and actually for myself, actually, to understand it a little better than I had in the past. There is now something on the table to introduce the possibility of using genetic testing to determine Jewishness in a way that's never been possible before. So in general, Jewishness is not really determined by genetics. Jewishness is determined by Mesorah, by your parents were Jewish, your grandparents were Jewish, by testimony, et cetera, et cetera. But now, given the new technologies and understanding of genetics, there is a realization that in our human genome, there are genes which are passed through the mitochondria, which will be talked about in a different light by Rabbi Dr. Glatt tomorrow in terms of definition of maternity. Are you going to talk about this, Aaron? Are you talking about this dimension you're not talking about? So I wouldn't talk about it if you were going to talk about it. The mitochondria actually are transmitted from mother to child. It's a maternally transmitted genes. It's not found in the nucleus. It's found in the separate mitochondria, which floats within the cell of the human egg. It is transmitted to the child. So in a very concrete fashion, for example, let me share with you very briefly a fascinating story which some of you may have followed about a year or two ago. Anyone familiar with the story of Richard III and the identification of the body of Richard III? Fascinating story. Richard III, briefly, King of England, never known where he was buried before, an ostracized king. For those of you who read the Shakespearean play, he was considered to be a hunchback, died on the battlefield of traumatic wounds to the head, never known where he was buried. Someone did some fascinating archaeological research, found out that he was buried in Leicester in some, make a long story short. They discovered a body which appeared for all the world to be like that of Richard III, but they couldn't prove it conclusively. So what did they do? The only way they could prove it is through genetics. They found, through genealogical research, two existing relatives that were maternal relatives, bas achar bas, from hundreds of years ago, from Richard III's mother, and they identified their mitochondrial DNA and matched it to the mitochondrial DNA of the bones that they found, and it was almost 100% match. So it proved pretty much unequivocally that these were indeed the bones of Richard III. So the question is, from a halachic perspective, if a woman who's been practicing Catholic all her life and finds out that she has the same mitochondrial DNA as some woman a few generations earlier, does that mean that she now becomes halachically Jewish or not, if that original woman was Jewish? So just food for thought, and there are other ways which it is being used, not necessarily in that way, but we'll discuss for another time. Let us turn to page 10, as we'll spend just a few more minutes to share with you some fascinating highlights. Page 10, earliest case of cesarean section. The New York Times reported a breakthrough in cesarean section history. Beatrice of Bourbon's survival in 1337. So in the history of science, the first reported living cesarean section, where a woman survived after cesarean section, was able to give birth a second time, was in 1500. So they found this obscure manuscript from 1337, big chiddush, that maybe a cesarean section occurred 150 years earlier than they had ever thought before. But the truth is, there's a debate whether it's cesarean section when the mother lived was occurring in the times of the Talmud, thousands of years earlier. The Mishnah in Bechoro says, Yotzei Dofen Vehabo Achrov. The Mishnah in the Bechoro says, if a woman has a Yotzei Dofen, she has a cesarean section, Vehabo Acharov, and then has a child after that in a second pregnancy, then neither of them are bechor for pidyon, because the first one was a cesarean section, and the second one was a second child, so there wouldn't be a pidyon aben for either child one or child two. So in the 1800s, you have on the right-hand side, a man by the name of Abraham Israels wrote his medical student dissertation to graduate medical school from the Netherlands in the 1800s on OBGYN in the Talmud. And he wrote an entire chapter that the rabbis of the Talmud were doing cesarean section thousands of years earlier than anyone else had ever imagined, and it started a flurry of fascinating historical discussions. Turn to page 11. Just an update on infectious disease. I know we have both Dr. Glad and Dr. Berman in the audience here, so I'm not going to speak extensively on infectious disease. But on this page, just this page alone, there have still been a number of major outbreaks in infectious disease within the Jewish community specifically. Measles, chickenpox, et cetera. We also in the Jewish community have been talking about the Zika virus and many fascinating discussions about the Zika virus. It seems that Baruch Hashem, obviously these things can always resurface, but at least for the time being, as you see in the middle of the page, the Zika virus seems to be somewhat resolving. Let us now turn to page 13. We'll spend just two or three more minutes and we'll close. In the world of transplantation, there have been some really fascinating advances. On page 12, we're not going to discuss in public forum, but there's fascinating halachic ramifications of the first ever male reproductive organ transplant. I listed on the bottom of page 12 some of the fascinating halachic potential ramifications for that kind of transplant. The possibility, it used to be called a head transplant. The possibility of a head transplant is advancing. In China especially, they're working very hard. You see on the upper right-hand side of page 13, mice that have had their head transplanted. You see white mouse onto a dark body, dark-headed mouse onto a light-headed body. Although they realize it really shouldn't be called a head transplant because you're not transplanting the head, you're transplanting the body. It's really a full-body transplant because you want to keep the head, assumedly. So you're really transplanting a full body. So they're fascinating questions in the Jewish world in this one. For example, if you transplant a non-Jewish head onto a Jewish body, is that considered a goyish cup or not? If you transplant a Kohen onto a Yisrael, if you transplant a man onto a woman, could solve the transgender problems in one fell swoop. But in all seriousness, there are fascinating halachic ramifications on that. Moving to the bottom of page 13, this one actually is very important to the Jewish community. Autopsies were first discussed in the 16, 1700s. Noda Behuda is famous for discussing autopsy. Rav Yaakov Emden talked about anatomical dissection in the 1700s. It still remains a major issue for the Jewish community. In the 21st century, it's possible to do what's called a vertopsy. So vertopsy is a contraction of virtual autopsy. And virtual autopsy is basically an MRI where they reconstruct the body. You can see everything inside the body, and you don't need to do an actual physical autopsy, which would desecrate the body. So in California just this year, legislation authored by the Assembly that would allow autopsies to be performed utilizing digital imaging technology. It would allow coroners to do this instead of a formal autopsy. And if you turn the page, by enacting this bill into law, we have honored the wishes of those who have passed, as well as provided the comfort and security to families who have these type of religious beliefs. And the last thing, and I see Moshe Kurzman in the audience, I'm just going to give him a shout out, and maybe I'll grab him later, you'll grab him later too, to discuss this fascinating case, which is too new to put in the handout. There's a case which is in the courts, still in the courts, right? Hasn't yet been decided in the state of New York with the following. And we've talked about the definition of death here in this conference in past years. But there was a case just about a month or two ago of a frum man who was in a New York hospital who sustained brain death. And actually at that hospital, he was diagnosed as being legally dead, and they filed a death certificate with New York State. After the diagnosis of death and filing of the death certificate, the family said, we consider him still halachically alive because we accept the brain death criteria. And he was transferred to another institution where he actually survived another 3 to 4 weeks. So the interesting question is, not to belittle the halachic significance, but here how it's being translated into the courts, is the financial issue. So who is paying for his stay for those 3 weeks at the second hospital? So the insurance company says, this man had a death certificate filed 3 weeks ago. I refuse to pay for any insurances for a man who's been dead for 3 weeks. But the family says that this person is halachically alive and should have been accorded the rights of anyone who is completely alive. And in fact, New York is one of the only states in the United States, maybe New Jersey also, right, that has a specific caveat that for those who have religious beliefs that brain death is not considered halachic death, that those people shouldn't be accepted as dead for those families, and they can be considered alive, whereas in every other state, they would technically be considered dead. So in brief, we've covered some of these issues. We hope to cover many of these other issues in the course of the conference. Look forward to a wonderful conference together. Thank you so much.